Ed Whitestack.
Hi there.
Cheryl should be joining shortly. I don't know whether anybody else is on the bridge yet or not.
Well, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I guess when they interrupt, then we'll...
Okay, we've got at least two others on.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Stephanie Hendrickson.
Hey, Stephanie. How are you doing?
Hey, good. How about you?
Good. We have Dwight on, and who else joined?
Rick Leishner.
Hey, Rick. How are you doing? Good.
Very good.
So, we'll give people one or two more minutes. Stephanie, how's your Jake doing?
Well, he's been sound now for 2 shoeings, 2 months. So I tried ponying him, and he has been such a bear, just aggressive with the other horses. I just finally said, well, okay, I'll ride him. So we've been walking hills. He's still weak in that right hip, but he's doing better. He's much happier being ridden and worked.
Okay.
I will say that. So it's just going to be a long, slow process.
Good. It's a good example of a horse getting lots of alternate therapy after.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything you can think of, he gets.
Yeah. Somebody else just joined?
Dwayne's here.
Hey, Dwayne. How are you doing?
Doing good.
And Dwight and Stephanie and Rick are on, and Cheryl will be joining shortly. We give people one or two more minutes to join. Dwight, are you, hopefully where you live, you're enjoying relatively low humidity, cool weather.
Relatively, yes. We're probably in the humidity right about now is probably in the 20s.
Right.
And we had a high of probably 84 today.
That sounds pretty good. It was like, you know, the U.S. just completed their selection ride. The first one was out in Illinois near where Rick lives. And they had a thunderstorm the day before, and then a hot, humid day. They were supposed to go 80 miles at 13 miles an hour. They ended up starting off at 13, ending up at 8 miles an hour and doing 50-some miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then the next one was like 90-plus degree weather in Maryland on the Far Hills course, and only 4 of the 8 finished. And I think they averaged a little over 11 miles an hour. And then the last one is on Argon, and the humidity and temperature together were 90. So, Jack,
wow.
Guess what? The Argon horses went at nice speed.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to be able to select horses when you have that much variation.
Yeah, I think the only good news is anybody who went to the selection trials is actually invited to go to the 5-week training course in Illinois, so they'll be able to see all the horses in the same conditions, and hopefully that will allow them to make some intelligent choices. Okay, well, Cheryl is about to join, and I think we'll go ahead. Yeah, I have the agenda, which is basically Dwight, for those who don't know, and Dwight did one of our calls earlier, I first met Dwight when he was chef to keep for the USA East team back more years ago than either of us should probably admit, but I think it was about 15 years ago.
Right.
And Dwight's one of the, I think, most experienced endurance vets I know anywhere. Dwight went on to practice in the Mideast for a half dozen years and was both a vet at the Dubai Animal Hospital as well as vet for some of the leading stables in the world, and now has fortunately returned to this country. And Dwight, you do acupuncture, chiropractic, and lots of alternate therapies in addition to traditional therapies, so best qualified speaker we can have. And Cheryl sent out an outline, which was Dwight's going to discuss, you know, broad categorizations of alternate therapies and then help us understand what we should do when. And I'll turn it over to Dwight and others for questions, and I think Cheryl is on.
Yes, I finally got on. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get underway, and since we have a a fairly discreet group tonight, I'd say that it would be entirely appropriate for anybody just to stop me wherever they want to and ask questions and feel comfortable about doing that. That may be the best way for us to maintain our continuity.
Okay.
But
yeah.
In general...
Dwight, hang on just a second. I heard one other beep, so let me just see who just joined.
That's probably me, Ann.
Oh, yeah, Ann.
Hey,
okay,
welcome,
great. Ann Isle is on, too, then. Great.
Good. Good. Hello, Ann. This is Dwight.
Hi, Dwight.
So it is... Now, are there more beeps? Hello?
You're still here.
Okay.
We're all still here.
Alternative therapies are a group of therapies that are also called complementary therapies, and everything listed in our outline falls into that category. And anything that is outside of traditional Western or allopathic medication is considered a therapeutic, or I mean an alternate therapy or a complementary therapy. And so how we would generally classify those is that in real broad terms, those are therapies for which there is some, and in some cases a lot, of anecdotal information to support their use, but for which there is relatively little, if any, scientific documentation to justify their use. And what that means is scientific justification is that studies have been done comparing this therapy with not doing anything or with doing what allopathic medicine would do for a particular condition, to see if any of these therapies have a better outcome or a similar outcome or a lesser outcome when used on a particular kind of problem. So that is where Western medicine or conventional medicine winds up being popular in some circles because it is pretty well proven. Now, having said that, I think everybody has an example in their bailiwick of some sort of conventional therapy, allopathic therapy for a particular disease condition that did not work and then was treated with an alternative therapy that did work. And that is true, but the numbers are relatively small and the verification, the validation of that is sketchy. So it's not to say that any of these are better. It's not to say that they are worse. It's just simply to say that they are not proven to the same level that allopathic therapies are proven. Now, as such, then, there are a group of people that claim to be scientists, veterinarians included in that group, who are critical of the alternative therapies, and some of them are critical of the alternative therapies for very good reasons, and those very good reasons are that they have examples in their bailiwick of therapies that actually can hurt a horse, or a human, for that matter. And we can specifically talk about chiropractic just because that one is more commonly recognized as a therapy that is utilized by an awful lot of people and an awful lot of critters, and that chiropractic has had, of all the therapies, has probably had the most scientific evaluation of any. But there are still cases, and I just ran into one today, a human who had a chiropractic adjustment that nearly lost his ability to move and to walk and to support himself as a result of a chiropractic adjustment. And it was a guy that had been using chiropractic for a long time and had had success with it. And so it just turned out that a bad chiropractic adjustment then wound up creating a problem for him. And so that sort of information is used as support by the naysayers, by the people who don't believe in it, to say, well, it can't work or you can't rely on it. On the other hand, there are the same kinds of stories available for nearly every allopathic medication. For example, there was a medication while I was in Dubai that was pulled off the market called Celebrex for humans because it was implicated in some high blood pressure complications in a very few patients but enough to make the company worried and therefore pull it off the market. There were an awful lot of people that benefited from that medication.
Dwight, this, you may want to come back to this when you get into more detail, but particularly for chiropractic, you know, my impression is there are chiropractors who do, for lack of a better word, I'm going to say fairly controlled, you know, precise work. And then I remember, somewhat to my horror now in retrospect, you know, a chiropractor came in and he was using like lifts with 2x4s and all. And particularly in the equine field, you know, how is there chiropractic work that is, you know, safe and sane versus some extreme practitioners?
Well, there is, and I guess that since we're there, that we should go ahead and delve into chiropractic. As I mentioned earlier, not so much in animal medicine, but in human medicine, of the alternative, quote, alternative therapies, chiropractic actually has the most scientific data to support its use of any of the therapies that we have on our list this evening. And in fact, in human medicine, there has been quite a number of actual scientific evaluations of those techniques. Now, there are a number of techniques of chiropractic that are used. Chiropractic, by definition, is the manipulation of a single joint at a single time to restore that joint to normal function. Now, what most chiropractors do, and when I say most, that's not entirely true, but in my personal experience with chiropractic, what people are actually doing is more osteopathic. Osteopathic is a motioning of the joints, but a global, it's more of a global therapy than a specific therapy. And when I say that, it is, for example, if you are having your back adjusted and a guy, a chiropractor, a guy or a gal, rolls up their fist and puts it under the middle of your back and then asks you to lie back on it and then they press down with their chest onto your chest, that is not a chiropractic move. That is an osteopathic move, but an awful lot of chiropractors do that. And in fact, it is one of the moves that I require to maintain my spinal function. But it is, in fact, an osteopathic move, not a chiropractic, because the chiropractic would require that they identify the specific joint that was out of place and then restore it individually. Now, they might restore two or three in a row, but they restore each one separately. Whereas, if they do the technique where they ball up the fist and you get the snap, crackle, pop of three or four joints at once, then that is, in fact, an osteopathic move. Now, osteopathic therapy is similar in its effect and similar in its delivery to chiropractic and is often confused with chiropractic. It's often called chiropractic. But the fact of the matter is chiropractic, by definition, is that you move a single joint at a single time in order to restore it to its function. What both of those two therapies attempt to do is to restore the movement of vertebrae to their normal function after there has been an injury. The injury can come to any of the soft tissues around the joint that allow the joint then to be compromised so that swelling occurs at the compromised joint and in some cases a displacement of the vertebra occurs, but most often it is not a physical displacement, it is a functional displacement of the vertebra by the fact that there has been an injury to the muscle or a swelling that compromises the spinal function. Now, people will talk about doing chiropractic on your elbow and doing chiropractic on your knee. Those are not really chiropractic moves. By definition, chiropractic is only the spine. But many chiropractors who are educated in how to manipulate the spine have then gone on to learn how to manipulate other parts of the body and do so. Now, the real question is, how much good does that do? And that is a real honest question, and I happen to think that the effect of manipulating joints away from the spine is of minimal value. Now, many chiropractors do that, and many chiropractors will argue with me, but in my experience, those things are of minimal value. I do think there is value to motioning the spine or moving the spine in a diagnostic fashion in order to try to determine where the problem is and then try to restore that. In humans, it works extraordinarily well. In small animal, it works quite well. In horses, it works well in the hands of a good practitioner, and there are relatively few of those. And the reason I say that is that in order to make to move a spine or a spinal segment, it requires either a tremendous amount of force, for which I don't have the ability to do, physically don't have the ability to do in a horse, or the practitioner has to be able to move really quickly. And that's what they teach all chiropractors, whether they be human chiropractors or veterinary chiropractors, that you have to be able to do make rapid motions. The problem is that to make a motion rapid enough to penetrate the large muscles of the back of a horse and have an effect on the joint requires a speed that is perhaps and probably out of the range of capability for most humans, myself included. So then if you talk about using force, then it requires that the practitioner have enough mass in order to be able to move a horse. So that also is difficult because an awful lot of people are just not physically big enough to do it. And I have the advantage in that case of my length and weight that I do have the ability to do some of those kind of moves. And then the last way to do this is with mallets or 2x4s or other devices. And those have use, are valuable in the hands of a really well-skilled and experienced chiropractor because those take the place of speed. But if they require more than a single thrust or a single whack in a single place, then that means that the person did not have good enough contact with that area or did not have a good enough diagnosis in order to be able to do that. And so what happens in those cases is that then you create damage in the soft tissues, in the muscles, and perhaps in the ligaments supporting the back with the impact, so that therefore the outcome may not be what one wants, what you want, because you may get more soft tissue damage than what you were going to fix. So at any rate, I am a bit critical of chiropractic. I am a chiropractor, and I do believe that it works, but it works only in the hands of experienced chiropractors. And I think that there are a lot of charlatans out there. And I think that one should be quite careful about the use of a chiropractor. I think you should spend a lot of time getting information about them from people that use them. If you look at the number of letters behind their name, that will give you an idea of how many courses they have attended. It does not have anything at all to do with competence, but with a number of courses and a number of years of experience, then you can oftentimes translate that to an increased level of competence. Wow.
The dog is giving a sort of a commentary.
But anyway, that's where I am on the chiropractic. And the real bottom line on this thing is, how do you find a good one? Because that's really the you need to find somebody that has experience, has knowledge, and has integrity. And those are, that's the reason I tell you, is talk to a lot of people. I don't think you can select one out of a book. I don't think you can select one from a Google search. I think that the only way to properly do that is to talk to people who have used that individual. So, anything you'd like for me to answer about chiropractic? Frequency of chiropractic was one of the questions that was added in toward the end of the agenda. And the frequency of chiropractic would depends directly upon the frequency or on the disease condition that you're trying to manage. And I would say to you that if you are a person that uses regular chiropractic to help manage your body, then it's likely more important that you manage your body regularly than it is that you have your horse's body managed regularly. Having said that, that also depends upon how your horse is managed in general. Horses that have the ability to go out and roll, have a place to go out and roll where they're comfortable, like a sand pile or in an open pasture. Horses that graze, spend hours and hours with their head down grazing, those horses need less chiropractic management than do horses that are stalled. The reason is that rolling, bucking, and kicking are natural ways of adjusting the back. And so if they have the opportunity in a paddock to, or a pasture to be able to turn out and go do any and all of those things, then that's how a horse would naturally manage their body. The things that create chiropractic abnormalities in horses are repetitive stress injuries and traumatic injuries. Traumatic injuries meaning like they take a bad step and that could, or they take a fall. And repetitive stress injuries are repeated stresses caused by a rider being out of balance and posting 9 million times in a 100-mile race. And so those are repetitive stress injuries comparable to people that have carpal tunnel, for example. Those are repetitive stress injuries that are not due to a specific and individual trauma, but to an accumulation of trauma. So if you can minimize the horse's trauma by having good equipment, and we talk about that for hours and hours on end in other forums, but good equipment combined with good riding habits and good balance by the rider is the way that you would best manage a horse's chiropractic needs. And then if you have a specific chiropractic problem that is diagnosed by a reputable diagnostician, then that could be managed in a routine manner as well. And the frequency would depend, as I say, I can't specifically tell you unless you tell me a problem, but those would be managed specifically by the practitioner that you've chosen and who is identified. Now let me take one more step with this chiropractic and then I'll take questions and we'll move on to something else. That one step is that if an awful lot of injuries occur that are believed to be chiropractic in nature, that are diagnosed by people as being chiropractic in nature without a proper lameness diagnosis. And so if anybody that has ever seen me do a chiropractic will notice that the first thing I do is put a horse on a lunge line on a circle on firm ground. And the reason is that I find that an awful lot of chiropractic injuries can be blocked out to the foot or can be blocked out to the suspensory or can be blocked out to one joint or another. And that once those are blocked with a proper lameness evaluation, then the chiropractic problem goes away. So I am adamant that if you're going to use chiropractic, you do not use chiropractic. Do not use a chiropractor to make your primary diagnosis. There is no question that a chiropractic problem can lead to a lameness. I don't have any question about that. However, it takes a really skilled and experienced diagnostician to be able to do that. And I know some of the very best in the country, and I also know that many of them diagnose lame horses or find lamenesses in horses that are called chiropractic, when in fact, if we block the foot, we'd find the problem. So I would implore you to, and if you don't do this, if you don't have a chiropractor that will do this, then do it yourself. Put the horse on a circle, and I always joke about using the Walmart parking lot at 11 o'clock at night, because it's well lit and it's flat and smooth and hard. But the fact of the matter is that any kind of firm ground that has reasonable footing will work. Put the horse on a trot, not in a short circle, not in a tight circle, and not at the end of your lead line or your lead rope, because those are usually not long enough. Go ahead and get about a 15 or 20 foot lunge line, and let the horses trot comfortably, relaxed, and at the end of that lead line. And if you find that they are off one way or the other, then get the lameness exam done first. Then once you get that done and you've taken care of any possible lameness problem, then you go to the chiropractor and have them evaluate the back. So with that, is there anything else I can answer for you about chiropractic?
You know, Dwight, you were saying, sort of turning around what you just said, you know, make sure there's not another problem first. In problems where the horses have, in particular, muscle soreness and muscle imbalance, that, at least my impression is, that can cause the misalignment in the spine because, you know, the muscles have gone into asymmetric tension and slight spasm. And so you've got to treat what's causing the muscle problem. So for example, one thing is we've done, we've had the chiropractic adjustment. Then we've also gone, you know, through a series of things to help the muscle problem. Then, you know, started retraining the horse, et cetera. Do you need, you know, if you've got a spinal, I'm not saying this very well, if you have a spinal misalignment caused by muscle spasms and you correct the muscle problem, do you need to do a chiropractic adjustment to get the spinal column back in alignment, or will that happen automatically? Does that make sense?
That will happen automatically if it can. And the reason that I say if it can is that the muscles that support the spine that are beneath the spine, so under the spine and over the abdominal cage, those muscles are, it's really difficult to get to them to physically manipulate them. And so those have to be adjusted or healed or fixed by a series of exercises and perhaps medication in order to strengthen. Those are like, when people talk to you about strengthening your core muscles, that's exactly what they are in the horse as well, is core muscles. And to support those muscles and strengthen those muscles, oftentimes that requires a specific set of exercises to be able to do that. If you can relieve the only thing that supports the spine and holds the spine in alignment are ligaments, some tendinous structures, and muscle. The tendinous structures are, by definition, attached to muscle. So, ligaments are kind of like a rubber band that is stretched to its normal limit. If you stretch it a little bit more, it breaks. And if you leave it at that limit, it has a short amount of motion that is within its physiological range that allows it to be able to hold everything together. Ligaments, by definition, are soft tissue structures that attach bone to bone. And there are ligaments between nearly every bony structure or joint structure in the body, maybe every one. And in addition, some of those are supported by muscle and tendon. That muscle attached to the tendon is what causes them to move. The muscle is what actually causes them to move. The tendon is the rubber band that connects the muscle to the joint. And so basically what it amounts to is that short of torn or strained ligaments, which we all know can happen in ourselves as well as in animals, muscle is the other thing that tends to support the entire body. And so, yes, if you can fix the muscle problem, then you likely can relieve the chiropractic problem. The reason chiropractic works is that the muscle is innervated by a nerve that comes in every case, that nerve comes from the spinal column in some fashion or another. And so if there is a swelling around where the nerve exits the spinal column and then goes down to feed some portion of the body, particularly some muscle, if that nerve is aggravated, then it can send abnormal signals to that muscle and then create the spasm in that muscle. So the way that chiropractic works is by adjusting the temporal relationship of one bone to another, which is relatively small, but that's what happens when the pop occurs. By adjusting that, then it oftentimes relieves the tension surrounding the nerve more quickly and then allows the muscle to heal more quickly. So, yes, the answer to your question is, if you can relieve the muscle, then you probably don't have to have the chiropractic. However, it may turn out that the chiropractic, in combination with the muscle work, will give you a more rapid return to normal. If I sleep wrong at night, if I fall asleep watching TV on the couch and then wind up sleeping there until the wee hours, and no, my wife doesn't usually make me do that, but if I should do that and wake up with a sore neck, then that soreness is going to go away in 3 or 4 or 5 days if I take enough aspirin and if I, you know, put a little heat on it, a little cold on it, take a shower, go out and do some work, it's going to go away. But if I go to the chiropractor and get a massage of those muscles, I might be fixed the next day. So that's the advantage, is that you get a much more rapid repair of the insult to the body if you combine the therapies.
Okay, great. That's quite helpful.
Anything else? Okay. Acupuncture and electroacupuncture. Those are therapies, and for those of you that may not know, and I think probably most of you do, acupuncture is an Eastern meaning a function or a therapy that came from the East, being particularly China, but China and all of that area. And those therapies were developed quite a long time ago, and the theory behind those therapies were developed a long time ago meaning 2,000 to 5,000 years ago. And that these therapies have been applied to animals both a long, long time ago and recently, and that the therapies that were developed for traditional Chinese veterinary medicine, those acupuncture techniques, were really pretty crude and something that most of you would not be willing to do to your horse. The more recent ones and the things that we use today, as in acupuncture and electroacupuncture, have been developed within about the last 30 years, and in large part were developed by Westerners. Initially, the French did a lot of work, sent people to China to learn how to do it, brought the information back to France. They began doing acupuncture there. It spread out over Europe, and then came to this country, primarily after President Nixon's aide, I can't remember his name, in the 70s, went to China, had an appendectomy done with nothing but acupuncture for his analgesia. So he was fully awake while he went through the procedure of an appendectomy and brought that information back to the U.S., and of course that excited everybody, and then we began investigating it more thoroughly. The techniques that we use today are an adaptation of acupuncture applied to humans. And so the meridians, they're called, or the channels that people talk about working on in animals are nothing more than an adaptation of what has been defined in the human over the past number of centuries and then applied within the last 30 years to animals. Now, that is part of the reason why the naysayers have a problem with acupuncture, is because that has been done within the last 30 years, and in terms of medical history, that's not particularly long. As we progress more and more in medicine, then it becomes a longer and longer period, but nevertheless, it has not allowed us to do an awful lot of research and validation of that therapy as compared to other therapies. It is, however, widely accepted as a therapy that works in humans. I have had it myself and believe that it does have a place, that it does in fact work, and that I have had success in animals from the same experience. I will tell you that with acupuncture in this country, we primarily work on pain, and primarily muscle and joint and structural pain, although acupuncture actually does have an effect on organ function. That requires, to do that properly, requires a Chinese medical diagnosis, and most every acupuncturist that's educated in this country gets that kind of education. Not too many of them make a Chinese medical diagnosis. Most often they'll make a Western diagnosis and then apply a Chinese therapy to it. And with that, that's probably quite sufficient for pain modulation. It's probably not very effective for organ function and manipulation of organs and their function in that fashion. Electroacupuncture is a relatively recent adaptation whereby we actually apply a DC current, so a battery-powered current, to the needles that have been inserted via a wire with a clip on it and a little charger device or activating device that generates the charge and sends it out via the wires. And there are a variety of different kinds of frequency modulating techniques that allow us to put different frequencies through those and be more or less effective on different problems. And for example, there is a technique that's called TENS, T-E-N-S, that's been applied for, been used for since the 70s, I believe, maybe a little earlier than that, but certainly since the 70s. And that's been applied either by clipping leads onto, electrical leads onto acupuncture needles in acupuncture points and applying the current, or it was originally applied by applying a sticker that with some gel that is a conductive gel, and that was just put on general areas of the body where there were spasm and then applied the same current. That then fatigued a spastic muscle, the vibration created by that fatigued a spastic muscle, and then allowed a chiropractic adjustment to be made after that, or the fatigue in and of itself may have been sufficient to reset the electrical charge within within that muscle and therefore allow it to begin to heal. That is, and so that technique of acupuncture is quite useful for muscle manipulation. It's also been used in the show horse industry to help take the fat off of show horses' necks in order to make them look prettier for the horse show. It's widely believed to be effective for that. I have sold those services in the past and felt a bit charlatanistic in myself in that I couldn't see the result of that. However, I have seen spastic muscles that have had electroacupuncture that have been repaired or allowed to begin healing by the use of electroacupuncture. For acupuncture and electroacupuncture, the frequencies for those therapies really need to be anywhere from every 3 to 7 days in an acute situation to as seldom as once a month in a maintenance sort of situation. And I really feel like once a month is probably ineffective and an ineffective use of your dollars for therapy, that there are other things that would be better, more useful to you as a therapy, unless you plan on using them very, very regularly. But as a maintenance therapy, I think that acupuncture and electroacupuncture, while they can be useful for traumatic injury, I think as a maintenance therapy, they're probably better ways to spend your money. And my suggestion to you would be things like massage, like myofascial release, chiropractic adjustment would be better uses of your therapeutic dollars.
Let me be clear, Dwight, for maintenance as opposed to...
For maintenance as opposed to repairing an injury.
An acute injury.
When you get an acute or perhaps even a chronic injury that you haven't been able to fix, then acupuncture is a useful therapy, but it requires... In my hands, acupuncture works at the very least on a once-a-week basis, and preferably on a twice-a-week or every other day basis when we're working on an acute injury. And my focus with that is not maintenance. It is to fix a problem and then go on to another therapy for maintenance.
Right, okay.
I will say that I have a TENS machine, and Kerry Ridgway actually looked at it because he said, oh, you couldn't have one that works, that's effective, and he looked at it and said, no, that is a good one, that will work. And I have a quarter horse that I run pretty hard in endurance, and he gets, because he's long in the back, he will get some lumbar issues, and I can put that TENS machine on him every 2 to 3 days after that for about 30 minutes to an hour each time, and it releases those spasms and gets him recovered very quickly, and I love the TENS machine on him.
That's exactly how it was intended to be used.
And on my Arabs, though, I find that they are very, very sensitive to the electrical current, much more so than the quarter horse, and I don't know if it's the muscle type I'm looking at or if he's just in more pain than they are, but I actually find it's more effective on my quarter horse than I do on my Arabs. They don't tend to like it as much.
And if you'd like for me to comment on that, I'd be happy to.
Well, you can, yes.
You didn't ask me for a comment, so I didn't want to just say. But what I would suspect is that your Arabs are more sensitive in terms of their nervous system generally.
Right.
And so that would be the reason that it has a different effect. And I wouldn't guess that it is more or less effective. It's just that they require probably less current, so a lower setting than the quarter horse would in order to get a similar result. And probably it's not so much a similar result that we're talking about. It's probably the point at which they become aggravated by it.
Right. They do much better with acupressure and massage as opposed to using the TENS on the acupressure points.
Right. And that I would say that's probably an across-the-board kind of thing, that most Arabs would be more responsive to a more subtle therapy than the quarter horse.
But if it takes off fat, I'm hooking myself up to it tonight, let me tell you.
Well, I can just tell you that I've done that. Now, I didn't use a TENS machine, although once upon a time I did, but I used there are currents that are called microcurrents, microamperage currents, and there are milliamperage currents,
mm-hmm.
in that the acupuncture tends to do better with microamperage current as opposed to milliamperage current, and I think that TENS machines are in the milliamp range. So that to use a TENS machine on an acupuncture therapy is probably a little bit of overkill in terms of the amount of electricity, and it may be aggravating to some horses to use that kind of current as opposed to the milliamperage current, which people claim that you can hardly feel the milliamperage current, and having used it on myself, I can attest to that the milliamperage current has much less palpable effect than does the TENS machine with the milliamp current. But I'm one of those that when I go to the chiropractor and I have a spastic muscle, I tell him to put it on the TENS frequency and to crank it up.
Correct.
And it really, it fatigues my muscles the same as it does your quarter horse, or in a similar fashion. And I personally require that level of therapy in order to release the spasm in my muscles when I'm in that situation. So at any rate, I think that there are, you know, that is a really good point that we should talk about for all of the therapies, and that is that individuals will respond to different levels of the same therapy. And so there, that is where it requires either a really attentive and insightful practitioner or therapist to be able to help determine which of those therapies and how to apply those therapies to get the proper result in an injury situation. So, anyway, now I'm going to move on to magnets and red lights and whatever else. That's the end of the first sentence. Magnets are a popular therapy for which there is little scientific proof that they do anything, and in fact, the scientists that I know say that it's really, really a bunch of hooey. That they that it's no way possible that a magnet at the level of Gauss, which is the measure of intensity, that are available in the marketplace. There's no way that those can have enough power to do any good. I do not use magnetic therapy, and so I can't really address for you how good that is. Now, I have a lot of friends that are in the Nikon business, and the ones that are making money at it really make a good case for how useful that is. The magnets that they put in people's shoes, I've got a pair of those that are out in my garage, and they are really good at holding up the calendar on the steel wall. And I wore them in my shoes for a while and could not tell any difference personally. Now, I know that there are people who continue to wear them in their shoes and continue to believe that they work. There is a device that has a couple of rollers in it, with tiny little magnets on the surface of rollers that look like they're about golf ball size. And people claim a lot of therapeutic value to the massage with those things. The problem is that I haven't been able to find a comparable roller with little knobs on it that's made out of just all rubber. I suspect that the all rubber ones would have a beneficial effect on the muscle, primarily because of the massage function rather than the actual magnetic function. So I don't want to be too critical of them because I don't use them. I did once upon a time, and I just didn't find that they gave me enough improvement in the condition to justify their continued use. But I certainly wouldn't tell anybody that they can't work. I'm just telling you that in my experience, in my hands, it has minimal value. I think the magnetic blankets do have a really good use in the fact that they hold in heat, and heat increases circulation, and the increased circulation is, in my experience and my belief, is what actually does the healing. Even the therapists that believe in and use a lot of magnetic therapy will claim that there is an increase in circulation as a result of the magnetic forces. And I believe that the increase in circulation is, in fact, what heals because of bringing more of the good, oxygen and to the muscle and carrying away toxins. But I don't know that it's due to the magnetic so much as it is to the increased heat that's created either by the massage function with devices or by the heat containing functions of the blankets.
So to expand on that just a little, if you've got boots or whatever it is, wraps for your horse's legs that can have magnetic inserts, you'd probably put the wraps on your horse's legs without the magnetic inserts and possibly get the same amount of benefit.
Well, you may, and let me give you an example. those there was a back magnet, back for human magnet, that was kind of keystone shaped and was about 6 inches long and maybe 4 inches at the bottom and 5 inches at the top, that had a foil on one side and supposedly a magnet, and it was really good, did a really good job on the refrigerator. I could put all kinds of stuff with that magnet on the refrigerator and it'd all stay up there. But it was sold to me as a therapeutic device for the back. And I used it, particularly when I would travel on the airplane, as I'm a little taller than average person, and airplane travel is just uncomfortable for me. And so I'd get sore in the back, stiff in the back. And I found that wearing that thing stuffed inside my britches, held up kind of by my belt in the back, really did help my lower back. But what I found out was that it was the circulation, and how I tested it was I just caught a piece of plastic. I took a bucket lid, piece of plastic, and cut that piece of plastic to about the same size and stuffed that in my pants, and found that I got as much relief from that. And it was because it would reflect, the foil actually probably reflected the heat back into my body and held the heat from dissipating. And so I believe that it was the increased heat that probably did more good than the magnetics. Now, I don't want to be critical of magnetics. It's just that they have not been well proven to me. And I do have a couple of friends who are really good scientists that I believe in that have nothing to do with horses that have shown me the evidence that suggests that it's not the magnetics so much as it's the increase in therapy or increase in heat created by the devices themselves.
That's sort of disappointing, but not wildly surprising.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to tell
you
that, but that's what my experience leads me to believe. The red light therapy is a therapy that has been quite useful in terms of the fact that what the red lights do, the red lights, for those of you that are interested to know, are an infrared light that is at a particular wavelength, and actually not a particular. There is a series of wavelengths from about 580 nanometers up to, I think, 630 nanometers. And so within that range of light frequency is where you find the red lights. And so applying those red lights to the body is effectively applying infrared energy to the body, and that in and of itself does two things at a bare minimum. Number one is it creates a heat that increases circulation to the area and therefore brings more blood to the area and carries away more toxins from the area. It also has been proven to activate nitric oxide within the tissues. And nitric oxide in the tissues, naturally created nitric oxide in the tissues, is a powerful anti-inflammatory agent. And as such, it reduces what are called, I'm going to have to think about that for a second, superoxide radicals, I think is what they're called. And that is an O3 molecule. And an O3 molecule, as opposed to an O2 molecule, can actually be injurious to tissues, toxic to tissues. And the nitric oxide somehow breaks those things up and dissipates that nitric or superoxide radical. And so that is how those things work. And yes, in fact, they do work. They work pretty superficially. The best ones can penetrate to about a half an inch deep. If they're powerful enough to go much deeper than that, then they also get powerful enough that they injure the skin with too much energy, so that they can create them up to numbers of watts of energy delivered, but when they get up into the much over 1 watt, then you've got to be really careful to keep them moving, otherwise you can actually burn the tissues. So those are useful. The ones that come to mind are the BioScan unit is one of the original ones, and I actually had something to do with the early ones. And they were useful. The people that were trying to sell them were sometimes not ethical, and so they sometimes would promise things that the machine just simply couldn't deliver. So
how many of those? I've seen these used, and they do seem to produce some degree of real results, which sort of surprises me. And at the same time, how small a unit can you have that can produce results? You say if it's over a watt, you're getting probably more than you want.
You need about a watt in order to do it in an effective time frame. Now, you know that the lights that people use when they deliver speeches and presentations, and they point to the screen with their little pointers, what they call pointers. Those things are an infrared device, and in the right range of frequency. And if you used one of those, one full battery per acupuncture point, then you could probably be effective. And it probably takes about 6 hours of holding the thing on in order to exhaust one battery. So it is an accumulation of, and the reason that they have some of these things that are up as high as a watt is so that you can apply them to a point or to a tissue and deliver enough energy in a reasonably short period of time to effectively do some good. Now, let me give you an example of where they do have a dramatic and powerful effect, and that is they have clusters of these things that have maybe 30 LEDs, and an LED is the little light source that actually delivers the energy when the battery is applied to the LED. Those things are, those clusters have, as I said, you know, maybe 30 LEDs in them, and when you apply those to tissues, for example, where you have one of those really nasty wounds on the back of the hock, where a horse got into barbed wire on the front of the hock, those things are incredibly useful to help heal those wounds because of all the things that I had mentioned to you that they do about increasing circulation and the nitric oxide effect of the oxygen radicals, is that that has a surprising effect on healing wounds. And on wounds particularly that require a bandage, then they are not exposed to much natural light. And the sunlight offers those frequencies as well, but the problem is it's hard to keep the wound open and keep it clean and non-contaminated with flies and support it properly, so that when you have those kinds of wounds, you can apply these kinds of therapies to them, and it has a remarkable effect on helping to heal the wounds. Now, as far as applying them to acupuncture points, if you're talking about individual points, then you need to be up in the half-watt to one-watt range in order to have enough power to be able to affect those points in a timely fashion. If you don't have, then you need to hold it on there, and there are charts that would tell you how long do you need to hold a half watt or a quarter watt device on a point in order to deliver enough energy, enough joules of energy to be able to affect the point. And so that's really what the bottom line is, the number of joules of energy that are required. And in order to, and I can't just off the top of my head give you any of those figures, because it depends so much on the disease condition in combination with the power of the device and the combination of points that you're going to use to fix the problem. So that's why if you're using red light, is it useful? Yes, it's useful. How useful is it as compared to what is the question? And so then you need to compare it based on the instructions that are given, the power of the unit, and the instructions that are given for how long you can apply it to a point. So, do you want to know if they're useful? Yes, they're useful. Do you know if want to know if they're worth the money? Well, it depends on how much money you're having to spend, how much power you get out of them. And I can just tell you that the ones, for example, that Kerry Ridgway uses probably cost $5,000. So you need to be pretty serious about your commitment to managing and maintaining your horse. And I'm not suggesting that anybody is not committed, but you need to look at, is that an effective way to spend your money to get results for the problems that you've got? And so for those kinds of, to answer those kinds of questions, we need to talk about specific problems rather than problems in general.
Will you, Dwight, this is Dwayne, will you comment on the K lasers that are out now?
Yes, I will. And okay. And those are simply a more intense power generator. They still have a similar effect on tissue, but they have enough additional power in terms of joules of energy delivered to the muscle or to the tissue that they work more effectively and in a more timely fashion. So I like those things because they are particularly for people like myself and like you that have a limited amount of time to spend working on a problem. That's an effective way to work on a muscle problem or a tissue problem, tendon, ligament, whatever it may be, that you can deliver enough energy to the tissues in a timely fashion to be able to do some good.
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed the subject that when Dwayne asked the question. This is laser lights, or?
Yeah, well, he asked about a K laser, and a K laser is particular. And I don't recall, you'd probably know better than I would, Dwayne, what the actual frequency of those is, but the frequency in combination with the kind of laser energy is more powerful than, for example, the red light.
No, that's fine. I knew it was in this category. I was just asking you to
right.
You know,
they're,
say
they're a little more expensive because they
right.
deliver a little more power a little more rapidly, but useful. Okay, any other questions on that part of the discussion? Okay.
Is red light the sort of thing that you'd leave in the hands of untrained practitioners?
Well, you can because it's so safe. It's probably not very effective in the hands of uneducated practitioners, so that if you were a therapist and you wanted to leave the red lights in the hands of somebody, if you gave them very specific instructions as to how to apply them and how long to apply them, then they could be useful. Are they likely to create a problem? Well, only if they lean on a point for a really long period of time is it likely they could do any damage, and even then it'd be questionable. But the other side of it is that they may not be very effective. And so my suggestion is for those kinds of therapies that the person that's going to use them really needs to spend some time going to school to learn how to use them, when to use them, and what kinds of problems are they're most responsive to. And if they go to school and say you can fix anything with them, then you probably ought to look for another school. Because I do believe that there are a huge number of problems that can be affected by chiropractic, and chiropractors love to be able to say that they can fix anything with chiropractic. And theoretically, that is true, but practically, that too is just not—it's just not practical. Mainly because it's so difficult for us to be able to diagnose a problem, and even the best chiropractors cannot diagnose liver problems in horses. And so, or kidney problems in horses, using their diagnostic techniques. Now, if they add allopathic or Western diagnostic techniques and then say that they're going to work on the liver or the kidney or the heart, then I think that that's entirely possible that they may have an effect. But to be able to diagnose it based on a chiropractic exam, in a human I think it's possible, but I don't think it's possible in a horse. Okay. What are those devices intended to address, which is the comment that follows the initial sentence? And what they're trying to address is pain in our situation. As I had mentioned to you earlier, that it is possible to affect an organ function. Give you an example of that is that in the mid-90s, I think I went to Calgary to work on, to be able to participate in the IVAS, the International Veterinary Acupuncture Society course that was being delivered up there for acupuncture. And when I went up there, I was having an awful lot of pain in my mid-back, in my thoracic region, in an area where I thought, you know, if I didn't know a little bit better, I'd say I'm having a heart attack. And luckily there was a chiropractor there that I happened to know and have a lot of confidence in, and I said to him, I said, would you look at my back and tell me I'm having this chest pain, I'm worried about it, it might be a heart issue, and if it is, I need to get someplace where they can take care of that. And he agreed. He said, if it's a heart attack, you don't need for me to be looking at you. You need to be going to the hospital. But he looked at it, and he found a couple of vertebrae that were in spasm. And he said, if I adjust this and the pain goes away, then it's not a heart attack. And it's just a spastic muscle that happens to be located just right behind your heart. And it is causing a referred pain that makes you think that it could be a heart issue. And so I knew enough about chiropractic and him to have him adjust me, and sure enough the pain went away, and I had him adjust me one more time, and it was gone for, you know, 3 months until I was bent over working on a horse doing the same thing that I did to injure it the first time, and then I got the same heart attack all over again. So that's why I say that that primarily we are dealing with pain issues that are structurally related rather than functionally related to organ systems. Now, after having said that, a number of my chiropractic friends tell me that they can fix stomach ulcers with chiropractic adjustment, and I don't argue that they can. They have not yet done it for me, and I keep asking them, but they have not yet done it for me. They have, however, reduced the amount of heartburn medication that I take by getting regular adjustments. So I do think that there is some other than pain functions that can be affected by some of these therapies. But primarily in our country, we're talking about manipulation and dealing with pain. Now, we need to back up one step here, because there was one thing in that initial list of therapies about which there was a question, and it is the Alexander technique. Alexander technique is a system for relieving stress and therefore spasm in the body, in the human body, that has effect on many different things in your life, and I will refer you to do a Google search for the Alexander technique in order to find out more specifics about it. But basically, what it does is it helps strengthen your core muscles and relax your superficial muscles so that you as a person would become more balanced. And the benefit of that is primarily in that if you will do things to better balance your body, then you will be a better balanced rider, and the better balanced rider will create fewer injuries in their horse, in their athletic partner. So that I do think that they are of tremendous value, and it's not just the Alexander technique. There are quite a number of other techniques that have been applied to human beings that are quite useful. The application of those same things to horses has not yet been proven. There are people who will suggest that you can do that and that you'll help your horse, but the main thing is that you'll help your horse by minimizing how much you interfere with your horse.
Thank you. That was useful.
So Alexander technique for us.
Yeah, yeah. And to expand on that just a wee bit, probably if you were to say chiropractic for yourself or acupuncture for yourself or massage for yourself or rolfing for yourself or on and on and on and on, all of those things would have, that would be as much benefit to your horse as having it done on your horse, because having a rider be fit and balanced throughout 50, 7500 mile effort has tremendous value to the horse. When they become fatigued, a balanced rider prevents a single muscle group from being over fatigued and helps the horse be able to distribute this stress over their body in the most equal fashion. And therefore, that's how I think that those techniques can be the most useful to you as an individual looking to help your horse.
Dwight, you're treading on sensitive ground.
I understand that. I understand that. But I'm in a long distance away, and you can't get to me.
That's true.
Right. I'm saying that just to reiterate your point, because we did a 92-kilometer demonstration ride because, as you know, two of our horses were nominated for the British nominees for the World Equestrian Game. And they wanted to see if the horses could go at fairly high speed. Basically, you know, we finished at 20 kilometers an hour. And we had they wanted videotapes and photographs and all sorts of things. And one of the British riders was riding one of our horses. Cheryl and I were riding the other two because Dominique couldn't make it out. And Cheryl and I have just been looking critically at all the video and the still photos, and the British rider, who's, you know, a 22-year-old rider, is just perfectly in balance in all these pictures. And Cheryl and I sort of, every now, you know, we see ourselves and say, oops, we weren't quite right there. So, I mean,
right.
I'm just reiterating the importance of what you said. But
and it is as important as anything else you do, as anything else that you do, is to try to help straighten yourself out, strengthen yourself appropriately. And, you know, that's one of the things that very few of us do, is to go getting ourselves into an exercise routine to help strengthen our own bodies, other than going for miles and miles and miles and miles. And the fact of the matter is that we probably don't need to go for nearly as many miles in the saddle to get our horses fit and able to do the event as we think we do. But what we definitely need to do more than we think we do is to work on our own physical strength and physical balance. So a couple of other things then that we should address. You wanted to know a little bit about ride day, after the ride, pre-ride, look for and do. What kinds of things should you be looking for and do? And I think that the thing that I would suggest to you, this is one of the most important things in my diagnostic routine, and that is to get really comfortable lunging your horse. And lunging your horse critically doesn't mean for a long period of time. In fact, the longer the time, probably the less information you're going to get. But I would do this every day on horses. When I was in the Middle East, we had tracks that were where we could exercise horses on a firm surface, not physically for conditioning, but mainly for diagnosis. But these were a hard rubber surfaced oval track, and we would trot the horses morning and evening. Every horse that was in competition or being trained competitively would get trotted every morning and every evening, and they'd be looked at one time a day by the trainer, an assistant trainer, and usually one time a day
by the veterinarian and the trainer and assistant trainer. Now, because I had so many horses to do over there, I didn't get to look at every horse every day, but I would look at every horse that was not right every day. So what would happen is that every morning the horses would be trotted, and usually trotted before they went out to train and then after they got back from training. And this was with a person, a handler, leading them, but not just straight out and straight back. We soon found out that they needed to go in the circle, and usually they would do both directions of the circle. And so you can accomplish the same thing by finding a flat spot, and sometimes that's a T in the road, or sometimes that's a parking lot, or sometimes it's a driveway. It just depends, or a pasture. It doesn't make any difference as long as you've got a reasonable surface to work on, and reasonable means it needs to be fairly smooth. It doesn't matter if it's got a little up and down in it, as long as it is regular. But trot the horses in a circle, each direction, on a lunge line. I would prefer that one person do the lunging and another person do the watching, but, you know, let's be practical. The fact of the matter is that an awful lot of times there's only one person to do every job, including clean the pen and feed the horses and fix the tires and change the oil in the truck. So I recognize that you may need to do it yourself, and I often, when I'm doing lameness exams, will be the one to do the trotting, to stand in the middle and ask the horses to go around me. The reason is that I know how to do it so that I can make the horse look smooth. And the smooth, consistent gait is what makes the difference. So, anyway, hang on.
And how do you tell... This is nice in some senses, but there's a part of me that says some lamenesses don't show up on, let's say, regular firm surfaces, only show up in deep going like sand.
I find that is not very often the case, and that, well, I don't argue that it does occur in some situations. The ones that tend to occur in a deeper ground tend to be more muscular and tendinous. The joint and ligament problems most often show up on the firm ground. But in my experience, I can usually see every lameness on the firm surface. Sometimes they are exacerbated on the softer surface, and therefore makes it easier to see.
Okay.
But I can almost always find an irregularity in the gait on those firm surfaces, regardless of the cause. And that's what I'm looking for, because I'm using the circle as a diagnostic to tell me that I need to look further, and mainly which limb I need to look in. And so once I identify the limb, the leg that is sore, then I start doing flexion tests, extension tests, muscle palpation, joint palpation, tendon ligament palpation, in order to try to identify where the problem is. But the main reason that I do it is that if you learn to do that and do that regularly, then what you find out is that is the tool that tells you to look a little further. Now, it may tell you as an individual to go feel that horse's feet, legs, muscles, to feel if it's hotter than normal, more spastic than normal, more painful than normal. Or it may tell you, hey, I don't know where this is, but I know that I need to get somebody to help me look at it. So then you would call somebody. Sometimes you will call the veterinarian. Sometimes you may call the chiropractor. Sometimes you may call the farrier. That's not the issue, who you called. The issue is that you have identified an irregularity, and if you watch your horse regularly every day or every training period or episode, then you learn what is normal for that horse in that situation, and that's something that is repeatable. So that's why it turns out to be useful, because its repeatability allows you then to be able to look at the horse on a regular basis and say, he looks different. Now, as a rider, you know that he feels different. But just knowing that he feels different, if you are an really well-schooled and experienced dressage rider, you may be able to tell me which limb it is that he's off in. But I can tell you that many, many times out of 100, people will say to me, he's lame in the right front, but when I look at him, he's in the right hind. And so I'm not being critical of anybody. I'm just saying that it takes a really, really well-schooled individual to be able to pick the proper leg before it's really injured. However, if you trot the horse every day on firm ground and you watch the horse every day in the same condition, then you can see that he's moving differently. Either he's got a head bob, he's got a hip hike, you'll see that he doesn't move one leg forward to the same degree that he does the other leg. He moves differently on one circle than the other circle, but it allows you, by trotting in the same place every day, to be able to compare apples to apples. You can always see what's going on, and you can make an educated guess about when it changes, and therefore it's time to get some help. So that's the reason for that.
Dwight, how, you know, say after a major competition where they've gone between 80 and 160 kilometers at you know, good speed, you know, competition speed, not just a average workout, and competition length, what percentage of horses would be showing you something the day after? And, you know, how long, I mean, when do you hit the I better call the vet button versus, you know, it's the day after a competition, they don't look quite right, but 3 or 4 days later they're getting a lot better?
Yeah, well, and that's pretty easy to answer, because for me, what I would do for what we did in the Middle East was that we trotted them. Usually we did not trot them unless they were pulled for lameness. We didn't trot them the evening after the competition, with everybody sore and everybody tired, and me included, and I didn't really want to know that night. If they'd been pulled for lameness or they had a metabolic problem, then we treated them, we took care of them. But if they completed the event, then we assumed that they were sound enough to complete, they were probably going to be fine until the next day. Now, a few times, there were a few trainers for which we would always give fluid after the event, because those events were always stressful. But to answer your question, it's pretty simple. You trot them the next morning, and then maybe the next evening, and then the following morning, and maybe the following evening, and you assess whether or not they are getting better. If they're getting better, if it's muscle soreness and just training or competition soreness, then you're going to see a gradual and steady increase improvement in their gait. And you're going to see that depending upon how much medication you use. But again, if you start trotting them every time you get a chance after that, then you're going to know how much better they are on a gram of bute or 2 grams of bute or 10 cc's of banamine or 5 cc's of banamine or 10 cc's of ketafen or Prevacox or whatever your anti-inflammatory may be. You're going to know how much better that horse is, and still whether or not the horse is improving on each subsequent examination or not is the indication. If they don't improve, if they don't change after 3 examinations, then you probably need to start thinking about getting somebody to help look at them. And 3 examinations might be 3 days. It might be 3 half days. It depends on what, you know, works into your situation. Now, for people that have a job and have to get up and leave at 7 o'clock in the morning to get to work and may not get back until 5:30 or 6 at night, then I would say probably a once a day is going to be a practical thing because they've got other things to do in their life. So once a day is okay with me, but I think that you need to look at them once a day, every day at a minimum. If you're talking about wanting to be in world-class competition, you need to be looking at your horse twice a day. in order to assess. Now, that doesn't mean twice a day every day. It means when you've got an injury or when you've got an excessive training episode going on, then you need to look at them morning and evening, and to be able to assess are they healing up normally at a reasonable pace, or do we need to get somebody to help us with a diagnosis and a therapy, or to evaluate whether or not our treatment is having an effect. Whether the treatment be massage, be drugs, be exercise, as in just, you know, walking around and grazing, but a forced effort rather than just a passive effort, even to assess whether the passive efforts are having success. You need to be looking at them twice a day if you're looking at being in international competition. The reason I bring that up is that this group, APEC, and a number of the people that have in the past participated in it have been talking about wanting to be involved in international competition, either as competitors or as support people, trainers, managers, whatever. And in those kind of situations, if we want to be competitive with the people who are winning in the world, I can just tell you that that's what they're doing. So that's what we need to be. We need to be thinking about doing that level of evaluation on our horses if we're wanting to be competitive with that group.
Let me open a can of worms, since you've sort of just peaked the lid a little bit, and I don't want to necessarily dive down here too much. What is it a? Okay, you've completed the ride. You've got your completion. You're not standing for BC, or you've already done your BC. But it's, let's just say, after drug rules have been passed. Would you, in general, give your horse some anti-inflammatories after a competition?
Do you ever take any anti-inflammatories after a competition? The answer is, for me, I would do it absolutely, and I would do it after everyone if I knew for sure that my horse was okay metabolically. Now, that is the critical question, is whether they're stable metabolically and whether or not you are comfortable with administration of anti-inflammatory drugs. But if you're not comfortable and you want to be at that level of competition, then I'm just going to tell you that that's what your competition is doing. And they're doing it pretty intensely. And they're doing it maybe even before they know that the horse is metabolically stable, but primarily they're doing that because they happen to know, they have veterinarians on their team to be able to evaluate that so that that even if the horse might be getting a stomach ulcer from overuse of bute, they know how to treat the horse for the stomach ulcer. And so your competition is competing at that level, is addressing the soreness issues at that level. And so the only reason I'm coming up with that is that I think that athletes in competition at that level are getting that kind of intensity of therapy. Now, if you're talking about national competition in endurance riding, then I don't think you have to go to those extremes, because we tend to give our horses longer to recover and more rest in between efforts. People that are in international competition tend to use horses a little bit harder and therefore require that they heal as quickly as possible. And so what giving anti-inflammatories after an event does is the same thing it does for you. It takes the pain away, allows you to get back to work, cleaning stalls, changing the oil in the truck, fixing the dent in the trailer, repairing the broken fences at home much more quickly, so it allows you to get back to optimum more quickly. does the same thing in the horses. It allows them to get back to optimum more quickly, and there are some disadvantages to inflammation. Inflammation typically is nature's way of reducing our effort or our ability to move so that we don't further damage the tissues so that the body can begin to heal. There's a really, really functional functional effect of swelling. It reduces your ability to move and therefore allows the injured tissue to be able to heal. The problem with it is that if we can use other alternatives to minimize the swelling and therefore increase the speed of healing, then we return the athlete back to competition sooner. So that's the reason for doing it. Whether you intend to return the athlete to competition sooner or not, minimizing inflammation and getting them to feel good again as quickly as possible has structural effects as well as the metabolic effects of helping them to get to feeling better sooner and therefore eat and drink and sleep and rest and do all those things that they would that they normally do sooner and therefore more effectively.
One question, you know, if I take aspirin, which I do after a competition, actually, because they don't drug test me, I may take it during a competition.
Yeah, right, right.
But I also know I'm on aspirin, right?
Correct.
And therefore, if I've got my head screwed, I'm a little bit more careful about what I do. Is there any danger, you know, for horses that are just turned out as opposed to, you know, in the stall environment of, and let's assume they don't have any obvious injury. In other words, they're not, you've trotted them out and they're basically okay. They've passed the fit to continue, et cetera, so you're not dealing with any known injuries. Is there any danger there then they're going to go, you know, out in their field running around and injure something because they're feeling good, whereas if they weren't on the anti-inflammatory, they'd be more careful themselves?
Well, of course, there's always a danger of covering up pain, and therefore they will not protect themselves. But my guess is that if they have that kind of pain, then you're probably going to not let them turn them out on the pasture. You're going to probably put them in bandages and keep them up in a paddock where you can watch them more carefully. If you have passed best condition, or not best condition, or that too, for that matter, but if you have passed a completion exam and the two-hour period after that you can't medicate and everything looks good, then the chances of you medicating a horse and turning them out and having them injure themselves is minimal, and the reason is that as much drug as you want to give them, you still can't fix tired. And so they're going to be tired after a big event, and so they're going to likely go out and rest, and they're going to rest more comfortably as a result of an anti-inflammatory assistance.
Okay.
So my feeling is the likelihood of them injuring themselves after a big competition due to having some sort of medication on board is absolutely minimal. And once again, I'm going to tell you that the people that are winning, and that's not just the people in the Middle East, but the Spanish and the French and the Australians are using, not so much the Australians, because they're a bit like the Americans in that they like the idea of being a drug-free sport, but they also like the idea of winning, and so the ones that like winning well enough are the ones that are pushing the boundaries and using as many drugs as anybody else is. But they're using them not for competition, but for recovery.
For recovery, post-mind,
yeah.
Right.
Anyhow, I'm sorry I took us down a bit of a side path there, but I found it interesting.
So I think that the reasonable thing to do is to understand that in endurance, we don't have many kids in terms of of athletes that are competing at upper level. And I'm not talking about riders so much as I'm talking, although the fact of the matter is we don't have many kids in riders either in endurance that are at that level, but we're mostly talking about horses and horses that achieve that level of competition are no longer kids. They're middle-agers. And
mature.
Mature. and we have some mature ones as well. But the thing about it is that those horses are not nearly so likely to do the silly teenager kind of stuff and injure themselves as a youngster. And so, therefore, I think that we're talking about a different thing, talking about a two-year-old thoroughbred racehorse as opposed to an 8-year-old or 12-year-old endurance in upper-level competition. So they're just for the fact that we have mostly middle-aged horses, competitors involved, then I think that you should recognize that the kinds of injuries that they're going to sustain are not going to be so much as silly accidental kinds of things as they are repetitive stress kinds of injuries.
Okay, and also following up on some of the aspects of, and in particular massage types of things, clearly, at least in my own head, there are times during a competition when massage makes sense. Pre-competition, I'd like to have the horse be sort of like primed in all ranges, so that sounds good. Post-competition, I would anticipate that the horse is frequently, let's just say, a bit sore. You can give them some NSAIDs or something or another. That may take care of that aspect of things. Does massage make sense after a competition? And if so, in some senses, how deep?
Well, I think that it does make sense after a competition, but in terms of if you have unlimited funds, then I would say, yeah, it probably does. And I can tell you that there are people who have unlimited funds to throw at their endurance competitors that will likely have some massage people involved after the competition. The fact of the matter is that most people are going to wind up using the NSAIDs and rest after the competition, and that when they have a specific problem that is that responds to a therapy, that massage may be one of the therapies that turns out to be quite useful. But that would be more likely to due to an injury rather than a fatigue kind of situation where, you know, a horse that, as you say, goes through and does a competition, finishes the competition in good order, looks pretty tired, you put him out, he's a little bit stiff the next day, then yes, if you had unlimited funds and you wanted to have a massage done, that would probably make the horse feel really good. If that horse were turned out for 3 days with 3 days worth of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, he might wind up feeling just as good at the end of the third day as he did if he had been massaged. So, I guess that if there's any financial implications to the use of massage, then I would say that it would likely be a little bit lesser of a priority afterwards. What I would probably do is I would probably wait until 3 or 4 or 5 days afterwards, just let them rest, have some anti-inflammatories. If you have the option, like you guys do, to be able to turn them out in a pasture, I'd put them out and watch them. If I had something after that, then massage might be one of the things that I would use. I would, however, suggest to you that a massage prior to an event might be really useful because it might help you identify a problem area that the masseuse could specifically address and get that area as supple and relaxed as possible prior to an event, and therefore perhaps avoid an injury during the event.
And how about, do you distinguish between massage and myofascial?
Myofascial is simply an advanced form of massage. And when I say an advanced form, and simply, I don't mean to try to make either one more or less important than the other. But myofascial release is a technique that's kind of a deep massage technique that gets down to the myofascial level and tends to look at spastic areas of myofascia, which is the covering over the muscle. Massage, by traditional definition, just is a muscle technique, and therefore the belly of the muscle is opposed to the myofascial portion of the muscle. The myofascium is that part of the muscle that actually covers the physical muscle, and it's that kind of white-looking tissue that joins different tissue, different muscle groups together, and it's the what you'd call gristle if you were chewing on it, and it's the white-looking stuff that, if you've ever skinned an animal, that covers the red muscle. And that actually can develop spastic and painful areas, and the myofascial release techniques actually address that specifically. So that's kind of a more advanced form of massage and has specific techniques in order to address specific problems. So that's a bit more advanced, and a good masseuse should either know how to do it or be able to refer you when those kinds of things occur. Those kinds of therapies are required.
Okay, now you talk about, you know, you use the word deep and going beyond traditional. Some of the stuff I've seen seems to focus on very light touch, and I can't quite decide whether that's foo-foo or whether that's, you know, triggering acupuncture type release points or what.
That sort of approach tends to work at the nerve level more than the tissue level. And the nerve level being that with light touch you can affect a nerve and therefore cause a release of endorphin or enkephalin, or send a message through the nerve to the brain and then back down to that tissue or another tissue to have a physiological effect on the tissue that's caused from chemical release rather than simulating circulation through the deeper massage tissue. And it is that those techniques, craniosacral is a term that is a kind of a chiropractic term, or it's used by chiropractors a lot or chiropractic people, that is a very light touch phenomenon. And for people that are very sensitive, those techniques work really well. I'm not one of those people, and in fact, for me, what they usually do is just the touch, and mainly I think that the horizontal position, the nice music, and the air conditioning usually put me to sleep, and I always wake up feeling better. but I'm never sure whether what happened.
You're more like a quarter horse than an Arab dwarf.
I am absolutely. So I just can't. Those are things that you need to speak with specific practitioners about, and specific situations, disease conditions. And I just want to tell you that if you're talking to somebody and you get to the point where you're kind of scratching your head thinking, boy, this is beginning to sound a little bit like bullshit, I think you need to believe that there's probably a little bullshit in there, and I'd probably steer clear. If they can make some rational points and have a rational discussion that makes common sense to you, then I think that it's reasonable to assume and rational to assume that those the kinds of therapies may be useful. I'm just telling you that I have not been able to have those kinds of things have an effect on me. I have been schooled in them, and I have tried them. And when I'm standing around with the gurus, I look really good. And when I get out on my own, I can't seem to make a difference in a horse. And so I don't use those kinds of techniques just because they've not been well proven in my hands. But I don't suggest for a moment that they can't work in somebody else's hands. But I'd really require a good, solid discussion and explanation that made common sense to me before I spent a whole lot of money on them.
Okay.
Now, the last thing, let me move down to some of the other things that were on the list, just so that the effect of massage during competition, I think that it can be useful during competition in the hands of a good masseuse. And that is that you get a repetitive stress injury that's working itself up, and primarily through a muscle spasm. They can help those muscle spasms, and they can relieve some of those tensions and allow you to get through. Now, do I think that they're going to be effective if you have to massage them at every vet stop? No, I don't believe that. If you're looking at getting through the last vet check or maybe the last two loops and your horse is starting to stiffen up, then I think it's probably useful to go ahead and have a good masseuse work on the horse. By that time of the day, the masseuse can tell you about anything that they want, and you will believe it because you're fatigued and you're not thinking as clearly as you might or as critically as you might earlier in the day. So I would probably look at the effects that those people have on horses in terms of results. If you see horses that are looking dodgy at the third and fourth vet gate but are finishing, then I'd have to believe that those guys are helping. If you're looking at horses that are dodgy at the first vet gate and then go out in the subsequent vet gate, I might question whether or not they're doing any good. Now, maybe the injury was greater than what they could fix, and I wouldn't argue that, but I would also ask then, is the therapy that they're applying or offering, is it really effective for that problem? So that is a matter of trying to find somebody who's good and effective. And you know, I can't tell you who on the East Coast can do that and be effective with it. You know, it's just too far away from the group of horses that I see regularly for me to be able to comment on that. But you guys should be able to evaluate that locally and tell whether or not that's something useful. The other question that was on that list is data on vitamin B loading and during the race. B vitamins are useful in terms of brain function and muscle function and digestive function. During the race, they probably have little effect on digestive function because the horse is stressed enough during the race that B vitamins are probably just not sufficient to assist with that function during the race. B vitamins are water soluble, and those of you that train yourself and take B vitamins, you'll notice that you urinate after the event or after taking B vitamins, and that your urine is bright yellow, and it subsequently gets less yellow as the event goes on or as the urinations go on. And that's what is happening, is that you're flushing those out. So they are flushed out. They're probably as useful as anything in terms of a preload prior to an event, in order to be able to help the body be able to digest foods as well as possible up to the event. My belief is that they, as a water-soluble vitamin, they are probably washed through fairly quickly, and that their benefit to muscle function during the event is minimal, and that addition of them is only useful if the body is deficient, and most of our horses are well enough supplemented with vitamins that they're not going to be deficient prior to an event. But it is quite useful to help to use B vitamins as a recovery supplement.
So post-race.
Post-race, right. Right. And for one reason is that B vitamins, B12 particularly, helps to stimulate appetite, and so it helps to get them eating again after a race if you've got a horse that has a tendency. But I would say to you that the benefit of B vitamin in terms of helping to actually stimulate the appetite is probably not nearly as great as the benefit of using antacids both before and after the race to try and help reduce stomach acid and therefore reduce stomach ulcers. Now, as regards to that, omeprazole has or Gastrogard is what the brand name is, has been criticized early on, and now it's much more accepted for use. And if it's used on a regular basis, then you have to be a little concerned about its effect on, and I had this happen to myself, so I can address it firsthand, is that I wound up with tennis elbow or golfer's elbow or both of them as a result of using omeprazole chronically. And it happened after a couple of years of use of that, and that within 2 weeks after quitting the use of omeprazole daily, the elbow pain went away, and that using ranitidine or Zantac now on an intermittent basis when I know I'm going to drink too much wine, when I know I'm going to eat too much spicy Italian food, when I know that I'm going to do the kinds of things that aggravate stomach acid, if I use it intermittently, then I'm able to take care of those problems, but without the side effects. And those are well established in humans. They're not very well diagnosed or established in animals. And so what I would say to you is that what it did for me is it made me use my left arm a whole lot less than I ever did before. And so therefore I actually even had some muscle loss as a result of it. So, but I didn't appear to be lame in that arm, but when I was squeezing my hoof testers, for example, with my left hand, I wasn't nearly as effective as I was with the other hand. So those are concerns. However, the use of antacids like aluminum hydroxide, and that is I can't think of the names of those products right now, but there are two or three products out there that have Tums in them, aluminum hydroxide,
like
and calcium,
and stuff like
carbonate.
That
those things absorb acid, and those are probably quite useful on the day of competition because they absorb acid and don't really give you that much calcium. People are talking about using them as a calcium supplement to prevent thumps. They probably don't do that because calcium carbonate is not well absorbed out of the gut. There are other sources of calcium that are much, much better for being rapidly absorbed that'll be useful in terms of thumps. And thumps is not just a calcium deficiency, it's also an imbalance of calcium and potassium. So that there are some other approaches to that particular disease other than Tums that are probably more effective. So, anyway, that talks about some of that. Herbal supplements and remedies, when they are applied to a disease condition for which a Chinese diagnosis has been made, then I think they're quite useful. For us to use a Chinese herbal specifically for a Western diagnosis like stomach acid, that's probably not going to be very effective. And so those are of minimal value in terms of assistance to competition, although there are a few of them that have been useful. In terms of remedies, flower remedies, for example, I don't think they're very useful at all in horses in competition. I just think that at that level they have minimal effects. They may have some effects in the pasture, but I think when we start talking about serious competition horses, I just don't think they're powerful enough to have any significant impact. Now, I would not say to anybody that if you have a really good homeopath and they come up with a homeopathic remedy that they can claim and justify and give you some experience to validate their uses. I wouldn't say at all that you shouldn't use them, but I'm just saying that for remedies, those are typically homeopathic or extracts of plants, and that it takes a really good homeopath to be able to do that and to pick up a course off of the internet and believe that you're going to be effective with it, I think is naive. So, a couple of other things. The last question on the list is about Lance Armstrong and the devices that can be used to monitor body temperature, and in fact, those can be used in horses and have been used experimentally in horses. And you're right; it's difficult to get them to swallow the pill. But if you were going to do something like that, and you had the only way you could deliver it would be to put it in the stomach just immediately prior to the first inspection, if we're talking about an FEI event, have the veterinarian stomach tube it into the horse, then it would stay there long enough to make it through the competition. And yes, they can; those kinds of devices can be used, and they're likely going to be of great value in terms of research in the future. And currently, the research has not been done to suggest how useful they may be, but in the future, I think that will be one of the ways that we actually do go ahead and gather information, and it's likely going to be a lot of other things, other than just temperature, although temperature is an easy one to do, but things like stomach pH and stomach acid levels and that sort of thing will likely be monitored in the future using those kind of techniques, and those things are available, but on an experimental basis only at this point.
And how are they read? Obviously, I mean.
They just emit a signal, an electronic signal. They've got a little tiny battery inside. They emit an electronic signal that is then transmitted wirelessly to a receiver that's probably actually on the horse, or they can be downloaded to a PDA or iPod or computer at a stop. But likely they would be, if you carried your iPod with you, there'd be an app that would allow you to download that information periodically to the iPod, and then you'd be able to monitor it. Eventually you put it on your heart monitor watch so that you could look at both the temperature and the heart rate evaluated rather than with the external device internally. And the advantage to that is that then you don't have wires to have to worry about, you don't have to have patches to worry about coming loose, and you don't have to worry about the patches creating sores on the body, on the horse's body where they're located under the skin. So I think that there will be a time when we'll find this technique will be used, and actually we can administer these kinds of things to cattle right now with a type of gun that goes into their mouth, and it just has a little plunger, and you deliver the bolus, and then they go ahead and swallow it, and that sort of thing can be done right now. And Jimmy Baldwin used to give electrolytes that way regularly during competition events when we were in the Middle East. So that technique is not new, and it's available today, and that would be a way that we could deliver those things. So
how does the stuff, let's just say, flow through?
in the same way that grain does.
Okay. It gets processed in the normal processing. It doesn't.
It's not.
They're
plastic coated so that they don't degrade at all, and they wind up being passed out in a few days. And,
okay.
Usually, within 48 to 72 hours, they're out on the ground someplace, and you may find them if they're bright yellow. You might find them in the manure as you're cleaning the paddock, and you might even be able to reuse them for all I know. It depends on the battery situation. But probably they're going to be disposable.
Dwight, I don't even know whether this is allowed or not allowed on FEI rides. It's not on ARC rides, I know. But there are very simple devices to measure blood sugar level now for diabetics, right? You can
right.
pick them up in any
grocery store.
Pharmacy. Do people use those either in training or competition to monitor the blood sugar levels of the horses?
In training, yes. Those and lactate levels have not been of great use in training like they have been in horses. I mean, in humans. In humans, they've been doing lactate levels for a long time, 20 years, in swimmers and distance runners and sprinters, for that matter, as a part of their training regimes in order to know when the athlete is in trouble, when the athlete has had enough work for that day, and when the athlete needs to do more work in order to go to another level of training. I tried that while I was in the Middle East, and it is difficult in horses to do that because they recover so quickly from lactate that if you're not able to jump off the horse, prick the horse, take the blood, and get it on the little strip and into the machine literally within less than a minute, then the horse dissipates that lactate so that you can't tell. So same thing with blood glucose is when a horse stops within minutes, if they are in fit and in training, literally, not minutes, within seconds, their blood glucose recovers. So that it just has not been a practical thing to use in training for endurance horses.
Before we, Stag, you and I monopolize things even further, I don't know who all is still on, but I'd like to open it up to other folks' questions, if there are any.
Well, and let me ask this, is that it is now 8 o'clock, and I have just got a message that I have a colic waiting, so I'm going to sign off. But I would ask that anybody that has a question, formulate it and send it to Cheryl, and she will forward it to me. Or you're perfectly happy I'm perfectly happy if you want to contact me directly. And I think my email address has been on all of the emails that have been sent out. But please send me any questions that you have or comments, and I'd be happy to address them. But I'm going to need to sign off right now because I just really need to go take care of this.
And I want to thank you very much, and I'm sure everybody else does too.
You are welcome. I'm happy to do it. Be glad to do it again sometime.
Great.
Thank
take
you.
Care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye. Stag, why don't we speak again on Thursday?
That sounds great. I'll call you Thursday sometime.
Sounds great.
Great.
Come on.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.